Come and Get It is the highly anticipated new novel from New York Times bestselling and award-winning author Kylie Reid. A fresh and provocative story about a college RA and her messy entanglement with a professor and three unruly students. Come and Get It is an intimate portrait of consumption, desire, and reckless abandon. Look for Come and Get It, available from Putnam, wherever books are sold.
What's it like to report on a presidential candidate when that candidate won't talk to you? Our own Amy Chozick discusses her new memoir, Chasing Hillary. And what does it take to write a great comedic essay? Sloane Crosley, author of Look Alive Out There, will join us to talk about her latest essay collection. Alexander Alta will give us an update from the publishing world. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. I'm Pamela Paul. Amy Chozick joins us now from Washington. She is my colleague here at the Times and also the author of a now New York Times bestselling book, Chasing Hillary, 10 Years, Two Presidential Campaigns, and One Intact Glass Ceiling. Amy, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Let's, before we talk about this book specifically, a little bit of background about your career as a journalist. Sort of how did you get into it? What kind of journalism did you want to do? And how did you end up on the campaign trail?
Yeah, I had a little bit of a non-traditional path. I grew up in South Texas. I didn't know anyone in New York or in media, but I wanted to be a journalist. So I moved to New York right after college. I had a stack of clips from the Daily Texan that I would like run around physically dropping off downstairs at Newsweek, at the New York Times, where a very polite security guard escorted me out, and just like hoping to get my foot in the door. And I, for years, I did like I temped at Condé Nast magazines, where I felt really out of place because everyone was so fabulous and fashionable. And then finally, a few years later, I got a job as the foreign news assistant at the Wall Street Journal. And this was a period when, after 9/11, when their newsroom was destroyed and Danny Pearl was kidnapped in Pakistan. And it was just a really interesting place to be with a lot of kind of smart, grizzled newsmen. And I just thought, oh, this is, and women. And this, I thought, this is, these are my people. And then I became a foreign correspondent in Japan for the Wall Street Journal. And my boss and the editor of the international coverage became Washington bureau chief right ahead of the 2008 election. And he said, how'd you like to go to Iowa and cover Hillary Clinton? So I go to Iowa and it's like as foreign as Japan was to me. I didn't know much about American politics at that time. I'd heard of this Barack Obama guy. I didn't know what a caucus was, which years later I told one of Hillary's top aides that I didn't know what a caucus was. And he said, that's okay. We didn't know what a caucus was either then. So it was a real awakening. And I kind of stumbled into political journalism in that way. But then I ended up continuing a hand in covering Hillary and the Clinton family. I went to Africa with Bill Clinton. I interviewed Chelsea Clinton, and then ahead of when Hillary left the State Department, the New York Times put me back on the Hillary beat full time ahead of the 2016 election.
I remember running into you on your Clinton beat once at a book event where Bill Clinton was giving a toast to the author. And this was where I realized that, you know, a political journalist is like a different animal in that the people in the room had set up, they had cordoned off the press behind a rope. And so, you know, you and I went behind the rope. I sort of obligingly and politely doing as I was told. And we were chatting and you were complaining about being cordoned off. And I think I turned to you to say something and you were just gone. You had found your way up to the front. There was just no stopping you.
Story of our lives, being cordoned off from the people we want to talk to and sneaking our way inside. I think I'd crashed that book party because I heard Bill Clinton was going to be there and his press team hadn't anticipated the ambush. But the book is, so many times me trying to get to talk to Hillary and get close to her and get some authentic answer from her and being kind of blocked by her cadre of male press aides. So that book party was very indicative of the larger problems of political coverage.
So people who are not political campaign reporters, this is like the whole world is very foreign because you would think from an outsider's perspective that there is a plane for the press and that the press are there to cover it and that they would therefore have access and there would be a system in place. How does it really work, or how did it work on Clinton's campaign?
Right. People always ask me, oh, what was your relationship like with Hillary Clinton? And I say, I had a relationship with her in my head. You know, the press has actually kept it up, especially, I mean, some candidates are different. John McCain was very famous for going back at the back of his plane and chatting with reporters. That was kind of the pre-Twitter era. But so every candidate is different. But with Hillary, she was a very, very cautious candidate who had built up years of scar tissue in which she didn't trust the political press. And so she was very cloistered off from her traveling press. So we would go with her. We would go to every event. Her schedule was our schedule, but we were almost always on a separate bus. We were, you know, sitting in the back of a gym. I mean, I write in the book that we'd go days and days traveling around Iowa on a bus only to see, like, the back of a blonde Bob, you know, getting into her own motorcade. And so one of the sub-themes of the book that I didn't even realize was sort of the evolution of campaign reporting and mm-hmm. how, if you look at these books, Richard Ben Kramer's What It Takes About 88 and The Boys on the Bus, and there was this camaraderie with the candidate and their aides, and it's just changed. I think it's changed so much. You're so cut off, and I think partly it's because anything in the era of Instagram and Twitter and live streaming, anything can become, you know, a major story.
Well, also, it was all women, right, who were following Hillary's campaign, or primarily women.
Right. It was a historic presidential campaign because it was the girls on the bus. It was on any given day, 18 of the 20 reporters who traveled with Hillary full time were women, and so I say in the book, call it a slap in the face from the patriarchy or a stroke of bad luck, but by the time the press corps was predominantly women, the kind of the role of the campaign bus in the media ecosystem had vastly diminished.
When you travel with these other women reporters on the campaign trail, what is the relationship between you and those other reporters? Are you your competitors, obviously, but you must be friendly as well. How does that work?
Yeah, it seems like it seems odd, but it really does become sort of a summer camp camaraderie. I mean, we're definitely competitors, and you kind of, you know, your heart sinks when someone else has a better story than you. But at the same time, we became incredibly close, and we talked about, you know, it's funny with all women. We were talking about things that the guys on the bus, the boys on the bus didn't talk about, like our fertility, and you know, and so we became incredibly close. Even people you would maybe not hang out in your normal life, there's a real sense of camaraderie that you're spending every day together. You're like scrapping around for any kind of healthy food, which is not easy, and you become very close. I've been texting with a lot of the girls on the bus who said reading the book made them nostalgic. I was like, nostalgic for the most toxic presidential campaign in American history? But there were these moments that we became so close.
All right. I want to talk about fertility since you mentioned it, and because you kind of start the book there too.
I wanted this book to be really personal. I feel like I'm a student of campaign books, and they're always great men getting inside the campaigns of other great men and this kind of knowing voice. And I thought there's this confluence of a woman who could become president, the first woman who with a real shot of becoming president, and an almost all-female press corps. And so there's an opening to write a really female take on a campaign book. And so it is. And part of that was bringing in my own kind of conflicts about having a personal life and a career. And when Jill Abramson, the former executive editor, put me on the Hillary beat in 2013, I was 34. So we were just starting to think, like, we should have a baby. But then it was like, but I got this amazing opportunity to cover possibly the first woman president for the paper of record. And I'd struggled so long to get into journalism that it was kind of incredible that I ended up there, and it didn't feel right to put it on hold. So yes, I think it's chapter two. I'm inquiring about freezing my eggs so that I can cover the 2016 presidential campaign. My doctor was very confused by this inquiry.
Is it a total spoiler to say at this point that you do now have a baby?
Yeah, it's all right. It's a happy spoiler. I do. I have a 10-week-old baby boy.
Can we just talk briefly about what it's like? I mean, hard enough to be on the campaign trail when you're trying to manage your fertility, but now you're on the book tour with a 10-week-old. What's that like?
Yeah, it's been really intense. I feel like these are, as you know, these are the two most kind of vulnerable things you can do is, you know, have a baby and have a book, and especially this book is really personal. I know you know memoir writing, and so it's been a lot. I mean, it's been kind of also amazing because every time I get stressed out about the book or there's backlash, I kind of like hold your baby, and then you remember he'll love me no matter what. He doesn't know about any of this, so it's been a real actually blessing to have both. Even though I was worried that I was gonna cry on Morning Joe or something because it is an emotional experience.
You talk about how you were given this assignment by a female executive editor of the New York Times, Jill Abramson, to cover a woman candidate for the presidency. Your editor on the politics desk was Carolyn Ryan, also a woman. And you're obviously a woman. I mean, so from the outside, people might say, like, wow, the world has completely changed. It must have been easy. There must have been no sexism. Was that the case?
This was a really interesting election year. I mean, yes, there were all these prominent women in her press corps. My Times politics editor was a woman. The candidate was a woman. And so there were some really historic moments. I mean, I think seeing a woman on those general election debate stages, and Hillary Clinton is such a gifted debater that, like, that was a real thing for little girls to see. I mean, there were all these moments where I felt, oh, this is historic. But then there was a lot of the same old boys club, same old things that you put up with in any presidential campaign. I mean, one of the things that's resonated with readers is the kind of sexist bullying by some of the men who worked around Hillary, and people were shocked. But, you know, this is the same world, and even though there was a lot of historic progress, you're still operating, you're still reporting while female in very much the same political world. It wasn't this, like, all of a sudden kumbaya moment and everyone's treated equally.
You called the people who worked for Hillary Clinton in the book, you refer to them as the guys, and then you have like nicknames for each of them.
Yeah. I mean, this is interesting because I think journalists have thought I was granting them anonymity, but this was really more of a literary choice than a journalistic choice. I started writing this book and I realized that this kind of six or eight male press aides, they all had very similar physical characteristics. White, around the same size, clean cut, same types of schools and background. And so for a reader, and they all serve the same purpose in my life, to control my coverage and so to protect Hillary. So I think it was hard for the reader, a reader like in my mom's book group in Texas, not a Beltway reader, to keep all of these guys straight. And the more I wrote, the more I realized they were this kind of tragic comic Greek chorus, mm-hmm. throughout the book. And so I created this multi-headed monster of the guys and gave them monikers that I hope kind of resonate with readers more than keeping these names straight. And I also thought it would be, and it has been, sort of a fun guessing game in Washington. I don't think some of them are more obvious than others, but it wasn't like a journalistic choice to protect them. It was more about protecting the story.
Right, here at the New York Times, we're all like, who's very senior editor? We're having our own little very inner guessing game. But you bring up an interesting point, which is that you could use literary devices here in the book that you can't use as a journalist. And I'm curious what that was like, sort of moving from a very kind of, rapid turnaround beat reporting to working on a book, and what possibilities that opened up for you as a writer.
I mean, it was such a luxury to be able to take a book leave, but it was also just the complete opposite of what I was used to. I was used to, like, writing news stories on my lap in a speeding motorcade or after a debate, and you're surrounded by colleagues and competitors and editors looking at your every word and helping you through all of it. And then all of a sudden I was alone in my apartment at my dining room table staring at the blank page. So it was a totally different writing experience. And one of the biggest challenges is I wanted this book to sound like your friend is telling you a story. I wanted it to be very much in the voice of a friend telling you a story. I kept thinking of Elmore Leonard's advice of, if it sounds like writing, I rewrite it. So getting newspaper writing out of my head was really hard. And David Carr, the late media columnist and one of my mentors, had actually said that was the hardest thing for him in writing his memoir, is getting that sort of Timesian newspaper writing out of your head and trying to write in your own voice. So that was a challenge. And then it's also been interesting to release it to the world, because I think people might think it's a newspaper, kind of a standard journalistic book, and it really is a memoir. So there are my own impressions in there, and I did try to explain that in an author's note.
What did you, I mean, you went into this campaign not without having had some Clinton family experience and Hillary Clinton specific experience, and you end the book with a photograph of you and Hillary Clinton taken in 2007. What, because it's a personal book, like, what did you go in kind of thinking of Hillary Clinton? What were your impressions of her?
It's funny. In the book I write that I, when I first arrived in Iowa in 2007 to cover Hillary, I thought, I'm writing this to the White House, you know, and I stood up and cheered at one of her rallies and was really embarrassed. It was the first rally I ever went to. And my friend, a friend of mine in the press corps was like, dude, you can't do that. You know, I didn't realize that how kind of detached political reporters had to be. And so from that period until when I started covering her for the Times and I write in the book, the relationship became incredibly toxic. I saw this very different side of not only Hillary, but the kind of circle of aides who have protected her since the 90s. And we had a very different relationship and a very kind of, I mean, I read the book that I worry that she hated me. I don't think she thought about me a lot, really, but the relationship was incredibly toxic. And I don't think, you know, we're not supposed to want the candidates we cover to like us, but I thought there could be a modicum of professional respect. And for a while during that very tense campaign, I did not feel that. So I wanted to end it with that photo in Iowa because I was still sort of wide-eyed about both Hillary, both the political process, the press corps, and what you could kind of accomplish as a campaign reporter, and it felt a little bit more hopeful to end on that.
Well, as you point out, there was a whole history between Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and Chelsea, for that matter, and the New York Times as an institution, and that the relationship that you had with Hillary may have been less about you two personally and more about her relationship with the Times as an institution. Can you tell a little bit about sort of why that fraught history? Where did that start?
This is something I think really surprises people. They think, oh, the New York Times and Hillary Clinton, you know, but there have been decades of animosity between their camp and ours. I mean, when I first got on the beat, I very much underestimated the level of distrust and toxicity between the two camps. It goes back to Whitewater. Howell Raines was the Washington bureau chief at the New York Times, and he is a white Southern man, obviously incredibly successful, and Bill Clinton's camp thought that he had some kind of Southern rivalry with Bill Clinton, two guys who scrapped their way to the top of their fields. And, of course, the Times broke the Whitewater story, which eventually led to impeachment. And they just always thought that Whitewater was a nothing burger, as Hillary would call it. They lost money on this land deal, but, of course, it created legal problems that haunted Bill Clinton's entire administration. So that carried over, interestingly, when Jill became executive editor. They decided that she had it out for Hillary as two incredibly powerful women at the top of their field. It was sort of the same Howell Raines, Bill Clinton rivalry now passed on to Jill. They used to say it's a Jill versus Hill. And Jill, since she left the paper, has written, I think, positive things about Hillary Clinton, and that narrative wasn't true. But certainly I stepped into this kind of, I was the latest recipient of this war between the two camps. In 2008, Hillary's people would be infuriated at the Times because we wrote about, for instance, Barack Obama's basketball games. Mm-hmm. And they said, she doesn't have any camera-ready activity, you know, camera-ready hobbies. What are you going to do a story about her water aerobics or her yoga? You know, they thought that some of those stories helped Obama. But it was interesting because when the Times broke the story about her use of a private email, Hillary had sort of acted like, I've seen this movie before. You know, she said, they're going to endorse me, they're going to hammer me about this, and then they're going to give me a big wet kiss of an endorsement. Those were her words. And so she kept going back to the 90s. I mean, it was funny. I was writing a tough story once, and one of her press aides said, I just don't want to see you become the Jeff Gerst of your generation. And I was like, who's Jeff Gerst? So I'm Googling. He's the investigative reporter at the Times who broke the Whitewater story. I was 12 when that happened.
Right.
Just to give you a sense of how these psychic wounds have not left her circle.
So how quickly did you become aware that this fraught history was there and that it was going to perhaps color your own interactions and experience on the campaign trail?
Pretty early on. I mean, I had still been optimistic because I knew these people from all my years covering her at the Wall Street Journal. And so some of them I considered friends. So I was sort of optimistic that I could maintain a relationship or work past it, but it quickly became very fraught and very difficult to do.
How hard is it to write about your current workplace?
It was difficult. You know, I love the Times, and I see the book is sort of a love letter to even ending up there. At the end, I end after Hillary's concession speech kind of like shocked that they even let me into the building after being escorted all those years earlier, and how I really couldn't have done it without having this great story, which was the first woman to get so close to the presidency. But yeah, it's difficult because I knew that if I was going to write a memoir, it had to be honest. You know, I could not just write like my coverage was perfect and everything was great, and you know, there's no pressure when you're a Times political reporter. I knew I had to be really honest both about my own flaws and the campaigns and the candidates, and otherwise it would just ring really false to readers. So I had I love Mary Carr, and I was really honored that she gave me such a great blurb on my book, but I read her book about memoir writing, and she has this advice of what would you write if you weren't afraid, and I put it on a sticky note and just kind of stared at it every time. I thought, oh shoot, like the campaign's going to be mad at me, or what used to be the campaign is going to be mad at me, or someone at work is going to be mad at me, or a family member is going to be mad at me. I just thought I have to be really honest, and what would I write if I wasn't afraid?
Do you think about what those people, you know, will think when they read it? Like, do you think about what would Hillary Clinton think if she read this?
I sort of doubt, it makes me sad, but I don't think she'll read it. I think, I really don't, but I did think about the people around her, the former campaign staff, certainly, and her supporters, especially those who have been really great sources to me. I don't want anyone to feel burned. I tried to use pseudonyms when appropriate. But yeah, certainly I thought about how, and then I also thought about how all of her supporters would feel in a way. I mean, it's kind of a weird thing to keep in mind, millions of people, but there's a lot of open wounds still, wondering why this very qualified woman lost to Donald Trump, and there's a lot of open wounds, and I did think about them.
It's really powerful in your book where you describe what it was like on Election Day, and Katie Turr in her memoir did the same thing, but from the Trump campaign headquarters, that certainty in the outcome and that feeling that everybody had. And it's interesting that both of you went to that moment toward the beginning of your respective books. What was it like writing about that day, and what do you feel like you wanted to get at in this book that maybe you couldn't have done in your sort of straight journalistic coverage?
Now, I wanted to set just like the mood, and people all remember where they were on Election Day and what it was like. I mean, Katie and I had the gift of being right up close. I mean, that last stretch of campaigning with Hillary, the 24 hours before Election Day, when we went to 6 different states and I saw her and Bill popping champagne and cuddling at the front of the plane, and Bon Jovi was, Lady Gaga dropped in. I mean, it was like, I wanted to capture the exuberance of that day and her and Hillary, who I'd covered for 10 years and I'd never seen her so happy. I wanted to capture that feeling, even if it's painful for some of her supporters to read. I wanted to capture really what it felt like for all of us, and especially since I had that front row seat. And then I think if you contrast that with the Javits Center, and, you know, people just, it's the end of the book, of course, but people collapsing on the floor in tears. I mean, it was just the kind of stark contrast of those two.
Do you remember the moment where you could sort of tell that it had switched?
So I was at the Javits Center, and the campaign had a lockdown on anyone talking to the press, which, why should this night be different than any other night? But it was very hard to get information, so my sources were texting me, and there was, I got a text from a very inside source, and he said, we're screwed if we don't hold the Rust, unless we hold the Rust Belt. And I just thought, what, the Rust Belt? She didn't even go to Wisconsin. You know, we went to Michigan once yesterday, and we haven't been, you know, these were not priority places. And so right when I got that text, I knew she was going to lose. And it was probably 9 or 9:30. And then a couple hours later, another source texted me, Wisconsin's gone. And then I knew. And then I told my team in the newsroom about the Rust Belt text and said, she's going to lose. And then the Wisconsin one was when we knew.
How did you feel at that moment?
It's weird. At the time, I think old habits die hard, and I was just like, I got to write. I was just in news mode. I was like, I got to report this out. I got to write the TikTok of how she lost for tomorrow's paper. I mean, I was so in news mode, and I got home like at 4 a.m, and the next morning my husband got the paper, and he was so excited to see it wasn't because we wanted Hillary to win, but he was excited to see my byline on a historic front page, you know?
Right.
And he was like, oh, I can't believe you didn't get to write that. And I was just, it didn't even register to me. I just thought, you know, I got to get to her concession speech and I got to write this really good inside story about how she lost. It took a while to kind of decompress and realize the scope of this historic surprise election result.
If you had the opportunity to have an interview with her now, what's the thing that you would most want to ask her? Like, what's that one question that just, you know, if I could only find out this, that you would want to know?
Well, this goes back to something a speech she gave in 1994 when she was first lady and her father was in critical care about to die in Little Rock, and she had to give this speech. And she gave this extemporaneous speech that I think best encapsulates who Hillary really is. She talked about the crisis of meaning in the country and that we need a kind of new social compact. It was very New Agey and rooted in her Methodism. And she was widely, widely mocked. I'm sort of fascinated by this speech. She was mocked by both sides. They called her Saint Hillary. They said she was preaching. And she never spoke that way again. She was just very scarred from that. And I think I've always wanted to ask her honestly about that speech and whether, and now I think, especially in the current climate, whether the country is still suffering from what she prescribed as the crisis of meaning. And I would like to see that kind of New Agey spiritual Hillary, who I think is the real person underneath all of that.
So you're on maternity leave right now, and so not worrying about this for the moment, but here at the Times, we are heating up for the midterm elections coverage, and across the country, obviously, people are gearing up. Now that there's this other big campaign going, people think that it might be historic in other ways. Is that something that you sort of look forward to, want to get back into?
Certainly, I think that presidential campaigns in particular are is fascinating to cover because they're such a barometer of the country. I mean, who knew ahead of the 2016 election that there was so much anger over inequality, that there was so much kind of hatred in some of these pockets of the country over how the economy had changed and impacted them. And so I am fascinated by politics. I'll still want to definitely keep a hand in it. And I also think in the midterms with all of these women running, it will be really interesting to see how they fare.
There's still time, I think, before Election Day for you to get in on that reporting. So perhaps we'll see more Amy Chozick bylines on the campaign trail. Amy, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. Great talking to you.
Amy Chozick is my colleague here at The Times and also the now bestselling author of Chasing Hillary, 10 Years, 2 Presidential Campaigns, and 1 Intact Glass Ceiling.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece, and in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS, not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Sloane Crosley joins us now. She is the author most recently of Look Alive Out There and previously the novel The Clasp and the other essay collections, How Did You Get This Number? And I Was Told There'd Be Cake. Sloane, great to see you.
Great to see you too. Hello.
So you were last here for a novel, The Clasp, which was kind of a different thing for you. And now you've gone back to essays.
Yes, I've returned to the mothership. I feel like it was kind of nice to go back to essays and be able to bounce off reality a little bit and not have to make everything up.
But are you writing a novel on the sly?
On the sly. It's not so much on the sly anymore. It's funny, you know, when you're like, when you're younger, it's sort of, you have this secret novel under the desk and you think it, you know, might be something that can happen. And now this is officially my job. So I am writing an official novel after this. But right now I'm just honestly promoting these essays.
Does official mean you're under contract? Is that what makes it official?
No. I think what makes it official is my willingness to say that without flinching.
Okay, got
it. Yes, there's a second novel coming, and it's okay.
But did you long to get back to essays after working on that novel?
I did. So originally, the way I got into nonfiction was sort of falling backwards into it. I had always intended to write fiction. But then I found myself in a sort of very happy home within comedy and within narrative nonfiction and personal stories. And it was nice to get back to them, honestly, and it's not even the genre, it's the fact that they end. So there's 16 essays in this book, and so I guess a cynical way of looking at it is that there are 16 endings, but to be able to sort of complete a thought and feel like it's really done and move on is something that you only get about, you know, once every 4 years with a novel, and you get a little more frequently with essays.
So it's interesting that you use the word comedy and not like comedic essays. Do you think of your essays as a form of comedy, especially, I guess, when you're performing them and reading them out loud?
When I'm performing them, I do, because I tend to change them a little bit. I bounce off the audience. I don't do what David Sedaris does, which is fully take notes and cross things out and redo things according to audience reaction. And that's not because I'm sort of more pure in my craft. It's because I'm not as brave as he is. But I do, when I've been sort of, you know, going around and performing them, as you say, it does feel a little bit closer to stand-up. When I'm writing them, it certainly feels like literary essays. I mean, the other thing is, when I'm writing them, I think, or the experience of reading them, you do get that second layer of something a little heartbreaking, a little sad, that's sort of embedded very slyly within the comedy.
I want to get back to the sadness, but,
okay.
But so you're sort of at the tail end of a very exciting and glamorous book tour.
So glamorous.
How
so many varieties of Caesar salad, really. No, it is glamour, and it's amazing to go out and to see how either the heart or the humor or whatever it is about the writing here does connect with very different audiences. So, you know, I went to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and San Francisco, California. I'll go ahead and say that it's in California, since I gave Tulsa.
We have a global audience.
Yeah.
Here, so.
But it's been absolutely wonderful. It's great to meet people. It's great because you get sort of the gamut of people who tell you that they started writing because of you. You get people who say that, you know, you made them laugh during a dark time. You get people who want to know where the reading of another author is and think that you might know the address. Mm-hmm. So you get really sort of the gamut from like wonderful fans and people who just happen to be in the bookstore. And it's really interesting.
You also, on your tour, I think, have one of those extra special tours where it's not always just you, right? Like, haven't you been paired with some people?
Yeah, it's a traveling circus. Or not really. I'm the circus. They're not moving anywhere. So it's unlikely pairings, although it's not really. I mean, Chuck Klosterman's probably the most likely pairing I had in Portland. But also I read with Zadie Smith last night. Her, Marlon James, Nat Rich, these people, Heidi Julovitz, I'm happy to know them. But what's interesting about it is it seems sort of unlikely to the naked eye. But the truth is that people who write, like, for instance, Marlon James writes, I think that everyone would be surprised to know how funny these people are, mm-hmm. maybe, you know, and they write these very serious things and they don't actually want to talk about them all the time. I mean, I remember I interviewed Joan Didion once, who, including, you know, Nora Ephron, David Rockoff, you know, all these people, is a hero of mine and, mm-hmm. and many people's. But I asked her editor for tips in advance. I'm like, what should I ask her? What could I possibly talk about with Joan Didion? And she said, she just likes to talk about babies in Sacramento. And I'm like, it's funny. I mean, not everybody wants to be interviewed about, you know, why they're a genius. And so for Marlon James.
Did you talk to her about babies in Sacramento?
I know nothing about either babies or Sacramento. So I really actually ended up just sort of asking her questions about why she's a genius. But I had no choice.
She was probably like, why didn't she just ask about Sacramento?
I just want to talk about the Santa Ana winds. I'm like, I can't do it. I'm sorry. I'm a New Yorker.
When you're paired with Zadie Smith, are you each reading individually? Are you having a conversation? Are you, how does that work?
No, she introduced me and interviewed me, which is a little bit, you know, like being interviewed by the Easter Bunny. But, you know, she does plenty of narrative nonfiction writing mm-hmm. as well. So we really talked about the sort of rhythm of humor and whether or not when you sort of open yourself up for a world of hurt from the internet when you write in the first person. And it's gotten a bad rap in recent years about, or narrative nonfiction has, about, you know, where I is the most common vowel and people confuse some humor writing with being about me, but I never think of it as being about me. I never think of it as memoir. I honestly only think of it to entertain or to, well, since I talked to Zadie last night, to only connect, if you will.
You're the observer.
Yes, of course. It's a different kind of observation than other kind of writing where I think for humor writing, there's an etiquette there. There's a sort of humanity there where you have to be invited to the party and attend the party. Mm-hmm. You can't just be completely, you know, J.D. Salinger in your cabin in the woods. But you have to be miserable once you get to the party.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that is really where I think my humor lives.
It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think that works for a lot of humor, too, for David Sedaris, for example.
Yes. And it's interesting how, you know, when you really get into it, how different humorists work. I think very much in analogies. I think that's where a lot of my humor probably comes from. Hopefully, I mean, I think I share some DNA with David Rockoff in that sense, at least just in that sense. And David Sedaris has a sort of lovely exasperation to his writing. Mm-hmm. And then I was telling Chuck Klosterman the other night, I was like, you think in scenarios, you know, what if you're placed in a room, what do you do?
Right.
You know, and that's sort of, and it's sort of very interesting when you notice these minor differences between your heroes.
So what does that mean, that humor is an analogy? Give us an example of that.
Well, I talk about my neighbors that are driving me nuts in New York as being like cicadas without the bonus years of dormancy because they're also about 17 years old. You know, I say they leave the music on, which is a tactic generally employed by war criminals.
Do they come to you naturally? Do they just come to you?
Yes, it's sort of how I see the world, which, you know, might be more a topic for therapy and not a podcast, is why does everything have to be like something else?
I think that's a reader's affliction. That's a reader's affliction
for
all of us, that we see things, we see the analogies. All right, since you brought up the neighbors, let's interrupt this little conversation to have you read us a segment about those neighbors.
A little ditty?
Yes.
Okay. So basically what's happened is I've moved into sort of a dream quiet apartment where there's, you know, cherry blossom detritus drizzling in the wind and robins landing on my air conditioning unit and everything is lovely until one day when it's not. And then one day the leaves dropped and Jared came out. Jared lived in the townhouse directly behind my apartment. He must have been on summer vacation or touring Europe by colonial rickshaw when I moved in. Jared was between 15 and 18 years of age, it was impossible to tell. I could never get a good read on his height as his resting state was slouched in a lawn chair, watching viral videos on his phone at full volume. And I never heard him say stuff like, "Looks like I can be legally tried as an adult now," despite being someone for whom the distinction was clearly relevant. How do I begin to explain my relationship with this creature? Is it a relationship if you've never met? Certainly, this is an acceptable dynamic online, but played out in real life, it's called stalking. All five of the windows in my apartment faced Jared's house, and for as many years, I heard every word this kid said. I would like to tell you that his woes were typical of his age bracket, unrequited crushes, parental oppression, social strife. But Jared had no woes. Plato advised us to be kind. Everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle. But I am here to tell you that I have witnessed Plato's exception. Jared's battle centered around selecting the right surfboard for show or for use at a beach house, both equally abhorrent, and the occasional obligation to come inside and set the table, and that he didn't have to do so long as he ignored the sound of his own name. Jewish guilt is no match for teenage entitlement.
Very nice. So that's from the essay Outside Voices, which is the second essay in the collection.
Yes.
I want to talk very quickly about the first essay, which is Wheels Up, because it's a short essay and, you know, you make fun of yourself, which is, I guess, a way in a
de rigueur.
De rigueur to disarm the reader. Well, actually, why don't you tell us about that one and why you started off the collection?
Oh, okay. Well, so there's 16 essays in the book and that one, essay is a big word for it. I think it's really more of a sort of tonal introduction, not dissimilar from the title itself, Look Alive Out There, which is not the title of any of the essays. It's just sort of a vibe that I want the reader to get. And that's a sort of snapshot of here's your host before I launch into the actual essays. And basically it's about, I approach a street corner in Manhattan and it's a very sort of old-fashioned New York essay in this way.
Because there's no Uber?
there's no Uber. But it's also because that sort of street life snapshot that, you know, how do you keep writing about this stuff without people getting completely sick of it or thinking only in New York when, in fact, a lot of, you know, people run into ex-boyfriends in Minneapolis all the time.
Yes.
But there is something only in New York, I think, about this specific essay. So I approach a street corner and I have my suitcase with me and I'm clearly headed toward the airport. And two people come up behind me and it's a woman in a wheelchair and her companion who's a man. And clearly I have the clear lead here. So they're going to, you know, take the second cab, but no cabs are coming. Finally, one drifts in our direction, but it's the one with the handicap access. And I think, my plane is definitely going to crash if I don't let these people have the cab.
Obviously.
And so I say, here, you guys take it. They say, thanks so much. The man leans down, puts his hands on both arms of the wheelchair, kisses the woman in what I assume is a casual assertion of their love, unhands the chair, and then he leaps into the cab and mm-hmm. she wheels off in one direction and the cab wheels off in the other. So basically, I then trail the woman for a while and follow her bad behavior for the rest of the essay, which is really only 4 pages.
Right. But she turns out to be quite the rogue.
Yes, she's a terrible person, but she's in a wheelchair. But so the sort of thing about it is that after she has a couple of more social infractions and I call her out on them, and a guy working at a bodega looks at me and says, she's in a wheelchair, what's wrong with you? But sort of that's the name of the game, right? So hopefully you're on my side by the time I'm accusing a woman in a wheelchair of being a bad person.
Indignant and misunderstood.
Of course, yes.
So it's interesting that you chose that very deliberately. As you said, it's kind of an introduction, a meet your reader or your guide here. And I'm curious about how you shape the rest of the collection, because someone, let's say a cynic who knows nothing about mm-hmm, writing mm-hmm. might say, oh, an essay collection, like they just kind of grabbed what they had written and tossed it in. But that's
you
not
know,
how it
collected
works.
Collected it into the dustpan.
Yes.
I mean, it's closer to that than you think. I mean,
all right. It all comes
really
out
now, honest.
So.
Yeah. No, it is. It's not that.
No one's listening. Don't worry.
Oh, good. No, I don't have a through line like some other comedic writers have. So I don't have a hue necessarily that, mm-hmm. you know, that you can mark it by like you would with Sedaris, for example. So instead, there's sort of these chronological and emotional check marks or even professional check marks. You know, when am I working in a day job? What, you know, what apartment am I living in? What neighborhood am I living in? So when I say my apartment, it's a reference that goes down smooth and isn't confusing. And then other than that, the sort of bigger arc is sort of the emotional arc. You know, you like to have a couple of big essays in between and not, you know, save your best material for last. But at the same time, there's a sort of an emotional build to the last essay, which is a sort of a giant one that is kind of this emotional blood on the field essay, where I think that even as a writer, I'm conscious that it takes a while to write these books. And this is my last opportunity to have the floor, as it were, for a long time. And so there's the humor in it, but it's also about the pressure for motherhood and fertility and what it means and looking into the future and sort of turning something that could be quite serious into funny. Because as most medical or traumatic things are in your life, you look back and there are moments where they're just sort of ludicrous.
Mm-hmm.
And so that essay tries to tap into that, and it all builds towards that essay.
As you're traveling around on your book tour, do you find yourself sort of collecting anecdotes, collecting ideas for the next thing?
Not really. Everyone always assumes that I've got that sort of divining rod on at all times. And I'm not that much of a narc. I think I would be just such a mess to deal with, you know, in my personal life if I was just looking for material at all times. Usually there's a line that tends to throw essays into a kind of sharp relief for me. I mean, sometimes it's a larger experience like the egg freezing essay. That was not written because someone said one thing. But there's an essay where I'm diagnosed with this funky inner ear disease that I had no intention of writing about until my doctor, with no irony whatsoever and in an effort to make me feel better, said, well, I mean, you know, Van Gogh had that. And I thought, well, look how that turned out.
Yeah, seriously.
And, you know, so every once in a while, something is sort of crystallized by a minor experience. And I think you can feel it in the essays, and that's where a lot of the humor comes from, that sort of bumping up against strangers in this strange world. But it'll take a while for anything that happened on tour to sort of germinate or marinate before it becomes part
of the writing. Is there any seedling that you can tell us about?
There's a woman who brought a 8-year-old girl to my reading who was named after me, which was trippy. But I don't think. But that's honestly
that's
just
a heavy responsibility.
Yes,
Sloan.
It is. Well, I
Were
kept on trying
like
to get
Sloan,
it off me.
Crosley.
No. I was
okay.
trying to. I kept thinking. Oh, you mean so
like, did
really
they get
Ferris
both?
Bueller's
yes,
Day Off,
yeah.
And then I'm just sort of a bonus round, right? But but that's not something I would write. That's something that sticks in my head as a human being walking through the world thinking that's trippy. I think that's way too frankly narcissistic to write about. This is what sort of separates the essays from cocktail party stories, is that's a interesting thing to repeat to a select audience or apparently the New York Times podcast.
That's right. It's just for us.
It's just us.
Exclusively
here. Yeah, because it's a little obnoxious, but where's the, I don't see the extra layer of how other people could relate to it. And then in terms of the seeds, I'm very protective over my seeds. There are a couple of incidents.
Well, we're happy with our obnoxious little anecdote then.
Okay. Yeah. Just it's in a tiny biosphere on the desk. It's not for public consumption.
We'll leave it there. Sloan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Sloan Crosley is the author most recently of Look Alive Out There. Alexandra Alter joins us now with some news from the publishing world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new this week?
So this week, the Association of American Publishers released their latest collection of data, and they were looking at sales trends in 2017. They just sort of crunched the numbers from last year to compare 2017 to 2016. And there were some interesting trends that they uncovered. The sales were pretty flat, but there was a little bit of a boost from adult books, which was interesting. So overall publisher revenue for 2017 was flat at $14.7 billion, and it was up just sort of 0.4%, so barely anything from 2016. Trade books actually increased a little bit, 1.3%. So they didn't grow as quickly as the overall economy did, but when you're talking about publishing, flat is sort of the new growth, I think, sometimes. And there weren't any huge blockbuster books last year. If you look at, you know, previous years when there was a major movie would come out, or there would be a big YA fantasy trilogy, and all of a sudden there were millions of dollars sloshing around. That didn't really happen last year.
Right, there was like no big YA, huge YA breakout. I mean, there were some. There was no Harry Potter action.
Exactly.
There was no All the Light We Cannot See.
Yeah, and there wasn't a big movie adaptation that sort of juiced sales for publishers. So the one kind of bright spot was that, you know, the little bit of a bump that they did see was attributed to a 3% revenue uptick in the adult books category, which
was interesting. Does that have to do with the price of books going up? Did the price of books go up or no? Or was that unit sales?
So this is revenue. So it's looking at basically what the publishers are making. And you know, ebook prices did go up, but ebook sales are falling. And that's related to the rise in prices that occurred, you know, after publishers regained the right to set their own pricing, sort of wresting that away from Amazon. So ebooks actually declined. It was for the third year in a row. They fell almost 5%. And the biggest area of growth remains downloaded audio, which grew almost 30%. And that's after several years of growth. So that's pretty interesting. In 2016, a lot of publishers were complaining about the election, kind of sucking all the oxygen out of interest in books. And that, you know, a lot of publishers were blaming the dip in sales on that. And then to see 2017 kind of hold steady despite the lack of a breakout book was sort of interesting.
So this is all positive, and I like to, you know, ignore any bad news
right.
when it comes to books. That said, one of our colleagues here at the Times, David Leonhard, had a really interesting column this week about book sales.
He did. He had a very compelling column with a headline that got a lot of attention online because the headline said, "Save Barnes & Noble!" exclamation point, essentially lamenting the state of Barnes & Noble, which has been in steady decline for a long time. And publishers are always worried about this because this is the last big bookstore chain standing for the most part. You know, you do have Books A Million, and the independent bookstores are doing surprisingly well after many people were kind of wringing their hands about the state of the independent market. Barnes & Noble, however, has really struggled. And of course, you know, they're up against Amazon, and that's been a real challenge for them. They had their own digital strategy that they tried to pioneer with the Nook, and that was pretty much a disaster. They've lost a ton of money from that. So he cites some pretty depressing numbers, you know, noting that the revenue from the Nook has fallen more than 85% since 2012.
All right, you're allowed one more depressing number.
I'll just leave it at that. But, well, they've closed a lot of stores, too. Let's just, without putting a number figure on it. On the other hand, you know, they have this kind of still they have a lot of brand loyalty. And when you talk to the people that work at Barnes & Noble or kind of pioneering their new strategy, they are hopeful and they're trying out new things. They have these concept stores that are sort of closer, I would say, to an independent bookstore than to your classic old big box store where it was kind of an impersonal large space with very little curation that you could see. I mean, they're moving, I think they're trying to move more towards smaller curated stores. They're adding restaurants with alcohol for parents that stuff out of their kids. Exactly. So I think they are trying things, and I do think they're a critical piece of the retail market, and publishers really want to support them, and so do authors. It's interesting how the tables have turned a little bit because they were often viewed as this big giant that was crushing independence, but now they're the ones that are – everyone's rooting for them to make a comeback. So –
yeah, I found the reaction to the piece, which was one of the most read pieces for the Times for a few days there, surprising in that regard, and that for the most part, people were supportive of Barnes & Noble and want to see it succeed, whereas it used to be back in the day, the big bad wolf that for many people Amazon represents.
Exactly. I think there was some, you know, in the publishing industry, there were some analysts saying, you know, the column did lay a lot of blame onto Amazon and, you know, antitrust issues like that. And some people said, well, that certainly hasn't helped Barnes & Noble at all, but they have their own problems that are of their own doing. And, it's not necessarily simply Amazon's fault, but they do have a strategy, I think, that they're trying now. So we'll see.
Well, here's to anywhere that has books out, whether it's a library or a bookstore.
Exactly.
So good luck to them. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
This year marks our lucky 13th year of podcasting. If you like what you hear, if you're a fan, please feel free to review us on iTunes. Joining us now, my colleagues Greg Coles, Tina Jordan, and Lovia Gayarke. Hi, guys.
Hi, Pamela.
All right. Before we talk about what we're reading, I just want to mention a few things on the bestseller list that I thought were interesting this week. First of all, overwhelmingly on nonfiction, it's The Current Moment. Oh, my God. At number one, A Higher Loyalty by James Comey. And I'm just going to do the sort of very overtly political books. Ronan Farrow with his book War on Peace is number three. Fascism, A Warning by Madeleine Albright with Bill Woodward is number four. At number eight, The Assault on Intelligence, Michael Hayden's book debuts. Obama by Pete Souza is on the list. Suicide of the West by Jonah Goldberg. God Save Texas by Lawrence Wright. And Russian Roulette by Michael Isikoff and David Korn at number 15. So it's crazy political on there. I think there's like one, you know, happy food book. And
really, because this time of year, we should be seeing, you know, diet books, right?
Right. Gardens and Joy. No. Yeah. And then on fiction, there are a number of debuts this week, but I thought very interesting. Rachel Kushner, our cover review this week, debuts at number four with The Mars Room, which is really...
That's a high debut.
For a literary book. Yeah. And the other book I thought was interesting, it was at number five, a thriller, is new to the list, Amy Malloy's The Perfect Mother. And Tina, I think both you and I read that book.
We did. And it's a debut novel from a woman who's, I think, ghostwritten a fair amount of nonfiction. And it's about a kidnapped baby in a mommy group in Brooklyn. And she lives in Brooklyn and got the idea when she had a kid and joined a mommy group.
I know. It's like Brooklyn Mom's Gone Bad. I actually have like a mea culpa here because a number of months ago, I talked about how I was reading a thriller, but I wouldn't name it because it hadn't yet come out. So that was the thriller. For any listener out there who is like still wondering what that unnamed book was, it was The Perfect Mother by Amy Malloy.
Now I can sleep.
That's right. I know. Greg. It's really been bothering Greg. All right, Greg, what are you reading?
Well, it's more what I'm not reading. I have stalled on Ulysses. I was very publicly reading James Joyce's Ulysses for the sake of the podcast, and now I'm very publicly failing to read Ulysses on the podcast. I have a good reason. I brought it with me on a trip a couple of weeks ago and didn't read even one page, but that's because I was reading other things.
Were in Geneva.
I was in Geneva, and in Geneva, I read a couple of work-related books, because I was talking to the authors at various events. One was a memoir by the writer Shulam Dean. He's a journalist and a former Hasidic, kind of ultra-conservative Orthodox Jew who was expelled from the Hasidic sect that he belonged to in New York State for heresy. And the name of his memoir, which was published by Grey Wolf a few years ago, was All Who Go Do Not Return. And it is kind of the explaining the sect that he belonged to, as well as how he came to question its beliefs and what the process of being expelled was like for him. The other book that I read recently was Paula MacLean's new novel, Love and Ruin. Paula MacLean, of course, wrote The Paris Wife about Ernest Hemingway's marriage to Hadley Richardson and second marriage to Pauline Pfeiffer. This book, Love and Ruin, is about Ernest Hemingway's third marriage to the journalist Martha Gellhorn. So Paula MacLean returning to Ernest Hemingway. And
she also wrote novels, Martha Gellhorn, not very good ones.
She did write novels. And in fact, they did fairly well. And she wrote some stories, but really famous as a journalist and especially as a war correspondent throughout the course of her very long career. I think she spent like six decades in conflict zones. The big climactic moment of Love and Ruin is Martha Gellhorn on Omaha Beach on D-Day. And Paula MacLean writes, there are 140,000 men and one woman.
Wow. And the woman I did not know that she was the only woman journalist.
Yeah. And in fact, she's the only journalist on the beach that day because all the other journalists, she's sneaked.
Were too chicken and they ran.
Well, they were all on boats offshore watching through binoculars. But Martha Gellhorn had been denied press credentials. So she had to lie her way onto a hospital ship. And that hospital ship happens to go to Omaha Beach and happens to land on Omaha Beach. And so she's out there carrying stretchers with the actual nurses and soldiers kind of helping out that day. So she's the only one who made landing. And Martha Gellhorn is just a remarkable figure. This book doesn't look at the whole scope of her career. It really only looks at her marriage to Hemingway. But it gets into kind of all kinds of questions about marriage then and independence for women within a marriage. And of course, Hemingway, you know, I told Paula MacLean when I interviewed her, in some way it's like you're his fifth wife. So those are the things that I've been reading while I've been stagnant in Ulysses.
All right. Well, you're off the hook then. Tina?
So I'm reading this book, Country Dark, by Chris Offutt. And, Greg, this was a review I actually inherited from you.
Yeah, and I assigned this just before I stopped assigning fiction.
Right. So I didn't know this writer. It's his first novel in two decades, I think. That's what I read.
Right.
He reminds me a lot of Larry Brown,
a little bit.
Winter's Bone. It's that kind of gritty, tough, southern, dark fiction.
Yeah.
I'm only halfway through. The plot is that a young Korean War veteran returns to like his backwoods Kentucky home. He meets a girl and starts a family and starts working for a bootlegger. But it's much darker than that because the young girl he meets, who's actually somebody he saves from being raped in a really gritty, horrifying scene, something's wrong with their kids. And they start having kids, and they have five kids at one point, the point I'm at, and only one of them is normal. And all the others are, you know, bedridden, you know, like infants, even though they're 10, 12, however old. And I can see it's going no place good because there's a county nurse and doctor slash and a social worker visiting them, you know, in the hollow where they live. And they're telling her that they're going to have to take these kids away. The kids are well cared for. I have to be honest with you. There were passages here, and I know the reviewer felt the same way, that were so dark that you just wonder, where is this going? It's really not going anywhere good. There's a scene at the very beginning where the young veteran, his name's Tucker, has been picked up by a hitchhiker. You know, he's the hitchhiker, and he's been picked up by a trucker. And the guy, old guy, pulls a gun on him, tells him to open the glove compartment and take a drink. And you're like, oh, my God, what's going to happen? He's going to get killed right here. But in fact, he slugs some of the booze, and he then turns and takes the gun from the guy and, you know, steals the booze and hops out of the truck and leaves. But so a lot of scenes like that.
So Chris Offutt grew up in Kentucky in the Appalachians. He's written about it. He has a story collection called Kentucky Straight. He has a memoir called The Same River Twice about growing up in really kind of the backwoods. But he made his way out of that. He graduated from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. So he talks a lot about how reading pulled him out of this community. But he returns to it again and again in his writing.
I mean, it's clearly a world he knows really well. You know, he's depicting it authentically, but with real heart.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's making me a little bit sad, but I'm going to keep reading.
Lovia, sad reading?
Sad reading, kind of, yeah. I'm reading Prostitute Laundry by Charlotte Shane, who is, I mean, I guess a Brooklyn-based writer. She's the co-founder of a small press called Tiger Bee Press and also has like a reading series in the city. Prostitute Laundry started as a tiny letter, I think in 2014, where she would just chronicle her relationships, her life, and her job as a sex worker. And it's just, I mean, and then I guess she turned into, it got a huge following, and then she turned it into this book that is so beautiful and so heartbreaking. I can only read a couple letters every night. And so they sort of like come with me to bed and I'm just like really sad. And then it's a memoir, obviously, but it's so intimate and her writing is so sharp and so clear. And she has this way of thinking about, I mean, things that I think about, right, like body image and having a relationship and being young and being in New York with such clarity that you sort of feel like, oh my gosh, this person is absolutely reading me and she knows that I'm here and I'm feeling all of these insecurities. So it's a book that sort of makes me feel like a little less alone, which is, I mean, it's not, I wouldn't say it's like a great summer read as, you know, the weather is beautiful, but all I want to do is curl up in my bed and read this book. There's a really great passage that I want to sort of read if I can, where she's talking about Maggie Nelson's Bluettes. And she says, at one point, Maggie says, clearly, I'm not a private person. I wonder about this, too, because there's nothing I won't write down and share, won't articulate in the most accurate and occasionally crude language I can manage. Yet I feel fiercely fenced with boundaries at all times. Maybe the issue is controlling the when and the how I relinquish my privacy instead of having it taken from me. Or maybe it's staying private from certain people in my life who I'm otherwise close to, protecting a part of me that still needs airing out, but only to strangers who I don't have to see the next day or whose faces I don't have to observe in the moment of reveal. I know I write down my life because I want to read it. I want to remember. I want to understand. But then why make it available to others? And so it's just this kind of like prose that, I mean, is just the whole book. And I feel like a part of the reason why I can't read a couple letters every night is because, you know, every graph is so full. And yeah, so I'm excited to see where it goes.
Pamela, what are you reading?
I'm reading a book that came out last year by Daniel Mendelsohn, who has written for the Book Review. He's written, you know, occasionally contributed for a long time. He was a former BookSend columnist. And as he delightedly sent me, he reviewed once an Anne Rice novel for us. But his full-time job is as a classicist. He's a classics professor at Bard College. And this book is called An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and An Epic. And it's one of those books, when it came out, you know, I thought, maybe I'll read this. It sounded great. Dwight Garner gave it a glowing review. It also got a very positive review in the Book Review. And yet, it sort of hadn't made it to my final to read pile until I saw him a few weeks ago being interviewed by David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, who was interviewing Daniel along with Elizabeth Alexander about memoir. And it was just one of those great panel discussions where everything works. You know, David Remnick is a really good interviewer. Both Elizabeth Alexander and Daniel Mendelsohn had written very different books, but both memoirs, and just had interesting things to say. And Daniel read from the book, and it was in his talking about it and reading from it that finally got me to sit down with this book, which is about his then 80-something-year-old father asking if he could enroll himself in Daniel Mendelsohn's freshman seminar on the Odyssey and take a class with him. And he would come up from Long Island to Bard in upstate New York and sit in on the seminar along with freshman students. And eventually they ended up taking a cruise together that visits the various areas that are covered in the Odyssey around the Mediterranean. So I'm still in the classroom part. What's striking me so far is really that our fathers, even though they were very different men in a lot of ways, were quite similar and geographically are kind of from the same part of New York. Daniel Mendelsohn and I both grew up in the same area of New York. So that's what is sort of most surprising personally for me. But it's also just a well-written book that really makes you want to frankly go and read The Odyssey again. So now I'm going to have that new Emily Wilson translation on my...
That may be next for me after Ulysses, because of course they pair. And in fact, Daniel Mendelsohn teaches them side by side often. His book, An Odyssey, is one that I've wanted to read as well since it came out and was well-reviewed. partly because since I've been reading Ulysses, two different readers have written to tell me, oh, I took Daniel Mendelsohn's class.
Oh, and really?
Yes, exactly. And reading the Odyssey and Ulysses side by side to see them. So Emily Wilson's is very much on my radar as well. Yeah.
All right. Well, now that an alert out to future listeners. If we don't hold up to our intentions, you'll let us know. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Inside the New York Times Book Review is produced by Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.